Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Angel Insights, where we hear from some of the top performing business angels in the UK and the entrepreneurs behind some of their portfolio companies. I'm your host, Tom Britton, co-founder of Syndicate Room, creators of the Access EIS Fund, which uses data to identify some of the top performing angels in the UK and builds a fund that co-invests with these angels. But enough about me, let's get to the show. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Matt Lerner, founder at Startup Core Strengths. Prior to founding Startup Core Strengths, Matt spent a number of years at 500 Startups, where he was a partner and headed up their London office. He was also at PayPal for a number of years, helping them grow and scale during arguably their most successful period. He's also been the founder of three previous startups. I've known Matt for a number of years, and I found him to be an incredible source of knowledge about all things product and marketing. So I'm really excited to do this episode. Matt, welcome to the show.
It's wonderful to be here, Tom. Always enjoy talking to you.
Now, if it's all right, Matt, I was hoping we could start by talking about your time at 500 Startups, because you headed up the London office and focused on their dojo, which was a bit different to their usual program. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, sure thing, Tom. So 500 Startups, historically, they've always had an accelerator in Silicon Valley. And when I joined the fund in 2015, to be honest, there were a number of accelerators already operating in Europe, many in London, organizations like Seedcamp and Techstars. And it just didn't feel like the UK needed another early stage accelerator. But as I started looking at deals, talking to founders, talking to people in the ecosystem, it was clear that where companies were struggling was getting from seed to Series A. And so we started we did invest sometimes at seed, but mostly post-seed accelerator that was really specifically focused on helping companies figure out how to scale their growth. So, you know, in early stage, it's everything from, you know, co-founder relations and legals and hiring and blah, 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 supply chain, whatever. We were really just focused on how to scale growth because that seemed to be where companies were stalling out. And to be honest, that was really the only thing I actually knew how to do, just given my operating background. So I brought in a bunch of folks who had been successful in growing companies of various kinds to be coaches and mentors. And we just brought everyone in and started working with them. We didn't really have a plan going in, but I think what we found is those of us who've been part of big successful companies realized that they do things completely differently.
How so? Because you think you get product market fit and then you've got that, so you just keep going with that. What changes that Series A or at that scale phase?
Well, it's even changes before you get to product market fit. The most successful startups that we've studied, that we've been a part of, they don't look like a tiny little slimmed down version of a big company. They don't start with a marketing department and a this department and silos and all those things. When it's time to grow, the entire company focuses on growth. And, you know, engineering, product, marketing, everyone works together and aligns around this North Star metric, this single number that increments, not revenue. It's something that increments when you deliver value to customers. And everyone sort of works together to optimize that number. So it's sort of like a different operating system. And then they don't have two-year plans and budgets. It's this process of experimentation that happens in very short cycles, you know, 1 week to 1 month sprints where you're going to try things out. We started by just giving these companies a bit of tactical advice about, you know, this landing page or this headline or this market strategy. But we figured out really was that the value of the program was in teaching people how to run this growth process and focus not just, you know, a couple of marketing hires, but the entire organization on growth when it was, in fact, time to do that.
It sounds like that's quite a shift. You've explained it as quite a shift from your startup phase to your scale-up phase. Sure. When you were reviewing companies for your program, but also, you know, for 500 in general, were there any signs that a company was capable of that shift, like early on, or was it very much they would come to you, you knew what you had to do to take them apart and put them back together to make them able to scale?
I guess we weren't really explicitly filtering on whether they could make the shift. Really, the thing that matters for any company is how quickly can you learn. And so I know this sounds super cliche, but we were looking for leaders and teams who had a growth mindset, people who were curious and constantly re-examining their assumptions, frankly, had the intellectual honesty to know the truth behind what they were saying in pitch meetings and knowing, you know, how much of that was the God's honest truth and how much of that was, you know, a little hope and a little dream and some assumptions that still needed to be validated.
Lots of founders, when they do pitch, there is a lot of hope and hype value. So How quickly can you pop that bubble, if you will, and take it apart and figure out what it really is? And what else were you looking for when you were looking at these companies that, quite frankly, sometimes didn't have much more than a deck to go with?
So in terms of popping the bubble, we sort of figured out that, you know, a lot of companies would come in sort of like high on their own supply, as it were. And so we spend the first week or two running them through exercises. We sort of called it humbling them, but to demonstrate to them in an incontrovertible way that many of their assumptions were incorrect, and just sort of opening them up to the learning.
So it wasn't a prerequisite that they necessarily had to be super humble to start, but you would take them through it.
Fundamentally, we were an investment vehicle. So we were taking, you know, the best companies that we could get. And some of them were great and already pretty open and humble with themselves. Some of them, you know, weren't yet. And we had to get them there so that we could be helpful to them.
Okay. Now, sticking with that line of thought, but moving beyond the ability to learn, what does 500 Startups look for when they're reviewing a company for admission to the program?
You know, I wasn't an angel investor before this. I'd only ever invested in public markets. And so when I went in, you know, and I have a fiduciary responsibility as a partner to follow the thesis of the fund. So I spent a lot of time, all the new hires investors did, with our managing partners, with our general partners, the people who had already written multiple checks into now billion-dollar valued companies. And, you know, the people who'd missed out and turned down opportunities in those companies, to talk about their thesis and their approach. And, you know, we followed it. I wasn't there to sort of invent my own thesis. And so the four components of that we were looking at seed or pre-seed stage were the founding team, the business model, product market fit, and traction. And out of those four criteria, you know, if you can see all four, generally you'd say that's a great investment, but you wouldn't write very many checks if that was your goal. And your LPs don't pay you to sit on cash, right? So barring that, at early stage, the most important things I think are the founder and the business model. And then as the things start to launch and the business starts going, then you're gonna look a lot more at traction. And then of course, product market fit is great if you can have it. But even product market fit alone isn't necessarily good enough if you don't, for example, have the right business model or team behind it.
And what about market size? Because you kind of hear like, oh, the market size has to be huge and it has to be this much. How do you take that into account when the company's developing a product where they're creating the market?
So it's notoriously hard at early stage because the market size is sort of two or three sets of assumptions downstream from the information you have at that stage. The way I think about it is there's some things that just very obviously by their nature, they're going to be fairly limited in terms of market size. But if you kind of rule out the obvious stuff, like, you know, this business literally only works in the UK because it helps people who are complying with this UK government requirement or something. If you kind of take those folks out, it's really hard to see. So for example, Airbnb was fundraising and their business was, in the beginning at seed stage, was people will rent out inflatable mattresses, you know, people who recently graduated on their living room floors. And all the investors turn them down because they're like, well, first of all, investors are rich and they'd never want to sleep on an inflatable mattress in a manky living room floor. But they say, I don't believe that's a big market. And they were right, it's not a big market. And what Airbnb turned into was a premium vacation condo rental business, which was apparently an enormous market. If you go back and look at Uber's seed deck, which is available online, you can Google it. All their market sizing estimates were like the private hire black car industry. They were calling themselves the NetJets of limos, right? Because Travis and Garrett were rich and they were trying to build a product to scratch their own itch. And they said their likely success scenario was like 30 to 50 million a year. And best case scenario was $1 billion a year business. The year before the pandemic, I think 2019, they made $11 billion. So if Travis and Garrett, who founded Uber, and, you know, Brian Chesky and Joe, who founded Airbnb, if they didn't know how big their markets were, you know, how's this?
What chance do you have? Yeah.
Who does?
Well, then what do you do, though, for market size? Is there a potential market size that it has to be worth for you to get interested in an investment or for 500? Or was it more, you know what, you're working on a really interesting product and let's just see where it goes?
I mean, I guess you sort of ask yourself, if this is really, really successful, how big could it potentially be? And sometimes, you know, there's an existing market you're going after, like the taxi industry, you can size that generally. Sometimes there's something where you're sort of going after, you know, a green field and there's no existing business there. And then I ask myself, what does this product help people do? And how many people potentially would want to do that thing? So like social media, right? You know, that wasn't a category, that wasn't a thing in 1995. There was nothing even like it. Okay, well, you know, how many people would want to post pictures of themselves on the internet, look at pictures of their grandkids who are far away, have a debate online about a political issue? Well, a lot. I guess that's kind of the best yardstick you can use. But again, I look at market size with a lot of humility.
That's good advice there, I think.
You know, the founders across the room, you can evaluate the founder. The traction is there or it's not. You can evaluate the traction. The business model, it you know, is high margin or it's low margin. Like those are all things that you can evaluate with a fair amount of certainty, even in a pre-seed pitch.
Now, coming back to your mention of greenfields and sticking with Uber, do you think that Uber was creating this new marketplace, or were they just shifting people from, say, black taxis and, you know, public transportation into cars?
Uber is a little of all of those things, right? They sized their market opportunity as a billion by looking at the existing incumbents. And clearly, there's a lot more than a billion. And where does that come from? Well, it's come from taxis. It's probably, as you said, come from public transit. It's also probably come from non-consumption. In other words, people who wouldn't have taken a trip now will take that trip because there's an easy way to get there or there's an easy way to get home at the end of the night. So I think some of it is competing with non-consumption.
I think you're right with that. But if we go back to one more example, so Apple gets a lot of credit for inventing things. What would you say for something like the iPod? You know, it came out, it was ooh and aah, it set off a trend in the industry, but was that a substitute? Was that a new invention? Or was it, like you've said, you know, giving more people access to something that they probably wouldn't have consumed otherwise?
There's a theory called Jobs to be Done, espoused by Clayton Christensen in his book, The Innovator's Dilemma, and about 40 books that came out after that. And it basically says people are trying to make progress in their lives and they're looking for products and services that will help them make that progress. And so if you view the iPod within that context of that framework, people have been trying to enjoy music for, you know, since long before Vivaldi, right? This is hundreds of years old, and the technology has changed over the years, but the desire and the task hasn't. And in the 90s, people were buying records and CDs and 8-track tapes or whatever. And you know, you couldn't just buy the song you wanted to listen to. You had to buy lots and lots of songs, and you had to go to a store. And if you didn't have a lot of money, you would like make mixtapes and record stuff off of, you know, the radio. You'd have like your little tape recorder next to the radio with the speaker on loud. So whenever you see people coming up with hacky ways to work around something, there's a business there. You know, people were not happy with the record industry when the iPod came out. And there were other MP3 players, you know, just like there were other sort of smarter than feature phones before the iPhone came out. There were plenty of other laptops before the MacBook. But none of them were well done or elegant. So the market demand in hindsight was obvious. People were underserved by CD players and the record industry. And so the iPod came and it was a much better solution at the time. And then, you know, since then it's been supplanted by Spotify, which is an even nicer, you know, more elegant solution, again, to that same problem, to help people enjoy music.
You did say something interesting there, because obviously the iPod and Uber and Spotify, of course, now have fantastic user experiences. But have you got any good examples of products that weren't necessarily great products or great experiences that still did rather well?
There's lots of very popular, not very good products and businesses out there. You know, we've talked about PayPal separately. You know, that's a product that a lot of people are very frustrated with, but they had a first mover advantage. And at the time, you know, when PayPal turned up, their customers were eBay sellers, and eBay sellers were mailing checks to each other and literally putting cash in envelopes and mailing cash through the post to buy and sell things online, because nobody could get a merchant account to just sell their old baby clothes on eBay. And so, you know, the alternatives were so crappy that this idea that you could send money to people with an email address was like a 10 times, 100 times better improvement. And the fact that sometimes your account got frozen and then you could never get in touch with anyone to get it unlocked, and sometimes a fraudster would steal your money, was like not a huge deal, you know, back in the early days when PayPal started. That's like one example. And then, you know, once you've got locked in with first mover advantage, people want to pay with PayPal. So PayPal will remain a really strong business. And the pieces that aren't that two-sided marketplace, the card processing parts of the business, you know, are largely getting gobbled up by, you know, disruptors like Stripe and Square, who can come in and do a better job, and where PayPal doesn't really have a moat around the business.
And there was another one that we talked about with Twitter, which I think at first it was text messaging, right? You would text your status in and then it would post your small status. How does something like that get a foothold when, you know, when Twitter was starting, there was MySpace, there was Facebook, there were hundreds, if you will, of other social media platforms. But what was it about them that gave them an advantage, even though they had, an inferior product?
I'm not an expert on the early days of Twitter, but my sense is that it's the fact that they had celebrities and that celebrities could communicate one-to-many with their fans on Twitter. You couldn't listen to, you know, whatever your favorite Kardashian was saying. You couldn't do that on MySpace or on Facebook or anywhere else. And I think, you know, once you're following a bunch of those people, again, you're pretty well locked into the platform. So it's clearly, it's working for somebody, you know, and providing them some value.
Definitely fair. We could probably talk about great and terrible products quite a bit more, because as you said, there's lots of examples out there. But I want to jump a little bit ahead to kind of the lessons you've learned, because you've had some incredible experiences, your own startups, 500 startups, and now Startup Core Strengths. I wanted to talk about your program. Can you give us more on that?
You know, there's no shortage of different marketing training programs out there, and there's some really good ones. Your marketer can learn to build viral loops or run Facebook ads or write landing page copy, but ultimately growth is everyone's job. And so by doing this virtual accelerator, we work with a bunch of people from different functions in your team and help you align the entire company around growth. So the product and marketing and engineering and, you know, whatever functions are working together to unlock that growth. And it's a bit of a tangent back to what we were talking about. You know, the reason Spotify was able to do what they were able to do was because they found some legal loopholes that would allow them to basically treat this music as broadcast and pay much lower royalties when they play a song for people. And that made the entire business model work. And that wasn't a marketing innovation, that came from the legal department. So that's what I mean when I say the entire company needs to focus on growth. So we'll bring a group in and then we take you through a series of kind of learn by doing exercises to figure out your North Star metric, understand your customers' hot buttons, you know, what language will resonate with them, what channels, you know, test and validate different distribution channels, activation, referral programs. And then we just bring in outside mentors, many of whom are actually still in Silicon Valley, who are experts in these different things to work with you. And you sort of learn by doing experimentation. Now, in terms of who we let into the program, to be really blunt and put my cards on the table, our goal is to be successful with every company we work with. We have like a wall of fame on our site where we've got companies who have grown 20x, 50x, 100x since working with us. And most of our new business comes from referrals and from word of mouth of people who've been through the program. What we're trying to do is stack the deck. You know, sort of like I once heard a story about a cardiologist who, you know, had like a 98% success rate, but that's because he would only work with patients who he thought had a good chance of surviving the surgery. It's not quite that mercenary, but we're looking for companies who are in a position to succeed. And that means, first of all, growth is their top priority right now. They're not in the middle of launching their product or fundraising. That they've got some people in place who are ready to do this stuff, and that they have the mindset and the kind of mental flexibility to change the way they operate and grow and learn at, frankly, a really cracking pace.
And what stage are you looking for, though? Because you said growth has to be their focus, but will you take early companies that are just a few people that are hell-bent on growth, or do they have to be a bit more established and have raised a round or two?
I've always been surprised by this because I had what I thought was the prototypical stage. But I ended up, there was this really nice guy and he really wanted to come in. He was a solo founder with just a couple contractors, but he had a working product and he was focused on growth. And he ended up growing like 30x off the back of the program. So I think the stage in terms of your fundraising milestones isn't necessarily what matters, but you definitely need like a product that you can sell to people that works. Obviously, that's kind of a prerequisite for going and getting customers, but it doesn't really matter hugely the number of people or even if you're pre or post product market fit. Yeah, you definitely need the people who are able to commit the time and have the right mindset and then a product to sell.
Given you've viewed so many companies and reviewed so many decks with 500 and Startup Core Strengths, Do you get a pretty good gut feel for a team after a 10-minute pitch, or does it take a bit more than that to figure out whether or not you think they're capable of adopting what you're training them through the program?
I'm thinking about this both as an investor and then in terms of my program interviews. You know, I think there's probably 20 or 30 or 40% of teams where it's just pretty obvious that they're not a good fit, that they just would much rather talk than listen, that they're defensive, that they're just not open and curious, right? Now, the other side is hard because I've definitely, as an investor, I've backed entrepreneurs who I thought were really talented and really committed to it and really bright. And sometimes I've just been wrong about that. I mean, not wrong about the fact that they're bright, but for example, I can think of people who's like, they're very bright, but they just don't have enough of an execution focus and they tend to overthink things. Or they're a very successful entrepreneur, but they've made enough money and they're not really in it as much anymore. So yeah, sometimes I've been surprised with founders that I've backed. So, you know, most of the questions I'm looking at now are trying to get a sense of how reflective they are, how much they're aware of the risky assumptions that they're making, just sort of having the intellectual honesty to know, as I said, the difference between what they're saying in their pitch decks and what they actually need to achieve in operating capacity.
Are there any stories you'd be willing to share with us about companies you were pretty certain were going to make it but ended up failing?
You know, I don't think as an investor, I don't think I was ever certain. But certainly when I go back and look and think about mistakes I've made as an investor, I can definitely think of two companies where an exceptionally bright founder, but once I started working with them, it was mostly just thinking through stuff, really complicated, impressive stuff, and just not enough like, okay, pencils down, let's try it. Let's not nearly enough focus on execution. I think that was one. Another one is, I think I underestimated people's ability to raise follow-on and how much that matters. You can have a great product, you can have a great business. If you can't go out there and get a lot more money, someone else is going to eventually outraise you and do it. That matters a lot more. This isn't like Warren Buffett, where you can find like a diamond in the rough and just sit on it for 30 years until the market realizes it's valuable. And so I sort of think, well, this person's not the best fundraiser, but this is an amazing team and an amazing product. And I guess that was the other one, is I kind of underestimated how important it was that they'd be able to get follow-on. And it may be a question of the founder, or it may be that it's in an industry that's out of favor and struggling to attract investment just because of the category.
Very clear. So you've been working with startups for a while now. And, you know, let's be honest, being an investor and being an entrepreneur take a lot out of you. What is it that keeps you motivated to keep doing what you do?
I got to a point in my career where I said, okay, there's lots of things I could do. There's lots of opportunities that could come my way, thankfully. How do I want to spend my time? You know, given that any of these will pay my mortgage, and that's literally, that is what brought me into early stage tech, into the VC world, and ultimately founded my own company, which is that I really do far prefer working with startups versus any other opportunity that I've ever had in my life. And I think there's two pieces to that. One is just the people themselves. And I mean this in the most honest, non-cliche way possible, but working in corporations, you have to be a certain way and there's a layer of politics and, you know, all of this. And frankly, at many levels, there's just a certain mediocrity. And when I work with entrepreneurs, first of all, entrepreneurs who are getting success don't tend to be mediocre people. They're bright and dynamic and they have a lot of flair and they're interesting and they're quirky. Some of them can be quite difficult. Some of them are hilarious, but just socially, you know, I get to spend my day with really bright, talented, interesting people who are doing incredible stuff. So that's one piece of it. And the other piece that I really got addicted to when I was with 500 Startups, it's the magnitude of what you can achieve in short order. We'd have an idea when I was at PayPal, and you know, 9 months later, it would sort of come to fruition if I could do enough political wrangling, and then it would be incredibly successful, and we'd earn an extra 1.5 cents per share, right? And you know, who would even know? Yeah. As opposed to, you know, working with a startup and you run an A/B test or something and you increase their conversion 4x and improve their unit economics by 30%, and suddenly, you know, the business is unit economics profitable, and you know, like the entire picture, the trajectory of the business changes. And that's just great fun.
Yeah, I definitely get that. So hypothetical scenario, 10, 20 years down the line, you decide to retire. When you look back on what you've done, what do you want your legacy to be?
Part of the reason I'm starting my own company is because I don't think I'll ever want to retire. Before I joined PayPal, I had another exit and I took some time off and I traveled. You know, after about 9 months, I was really bored. I realized I'm not sure I'm really cut out for not working. But I do think about my legacy and why I'm doing what I'm doing. Back to the stuff we talked about, you know, where successful startups on the inside don't look anything at all like the big companies of today. They don't have those sort of silos and they align the entire company around growth. And I see now a number of companies who've gotten to huge scale with that same sort of organization, like Amazon and Facebook, you know, are a couple examples where they're still lean and they're still organized around a North Star metric, and they have been for many years. I think that in 10 or 20 years, companies are just gonna all work that way, because the ones that don't work like that are gonna be eaten by the ones who do. So I feel like there's this revolution in terms of the way people structure and run and grow companies. That's kind of like what happened in lean. Like, you know, if you look in the early 2000s, people moved from waterfall product development to lean and sprints and agile. And I feel like there's a sort of an analogous shift in process that's going to happen in terms of how companies grow. And, you know, I've built my business to help startups learn that, particularly startups in Europe, to give them a tactical advantage. I'd love for my legacy to be that I helped to propagate that out and helped a bunch of really good founders and companies to be successful where they couldn't have otherwise.
Amazing. Do you have any regrets about what you've done or not done yet? Not just looking at legacy and what you want it to be, but anything that you've yet to achieve that you still want to do?
I'm starting this company kind of late in my career, and you know, everything's obvious in hindsight, but this feels like something that should have happened a long time ago. The world has needed it, and clearly, you know, the traction is there. So I'm sure there's lots of things like that I regret. But honestly, when I look back, you know, so far, I've had a pretty amazing life, and I've been quite content, and I've done a lot of things that I'm really proud of. So nothing that really keeps me up at night.
I definitely get you on that, but I'd also argue that had you tried to do this earlier in your career, you might not have been so successful. You know, you've got some incredible experience that's helped you build this business and impart more knowledge on the companies you work with. They might not have been as successful if you didn't have all of that experience to share.
It's true, but I guess I find with an entrepreneurial journey, when you have an idea, you need to stop thinking about it and do it. Because even if the stuff doesn't work, trying stuff, you learn much, much, much faster than you do thinking about stuff. You know, I think even if it wasn't this business, if I started my entrepreneurial journey in this direction earlier, I probably would have learned faster. But point taken about the experience I got as an investor with 500, that was incredibly valuable.
Yeah. So coming to the end of this wonderful conversation, I've got a few quickfire questions to ask you that we try and ask everyone at the end of the show. And then I want you to share the first things that come to mind when I ask them. So what's the best book that you've read recently from any genre? It doesn't have to be business or about startups.
There's a book I'm just finished listening to. It's old. It's from like 1992, and it's called Thinking in Systems by Donella Meadows. It's systems thinking, right? And so it's incredibly applicable. And a lot of this stuff I kind of knew or learned in uni or something, but hearing about it now with a lens of thinking about my own business and the companies I work with in terms of, you know, throughput and constraints and feedback loops and aligning organizations, is super, super powerful. And if you're leading and trying to build an organization, I think it's really well worth a listen.
I will be reading that soon. Second quickfire question, you know, what's the tech trend that interests you most at present?
Putting my investor hat on, I feel like maybe three industries that are going to just be really profoundly changing. One of them is health tech, which is, you know, I kind of define as that space between fast-moving consumer goods and actual healthcare. As an investor, I backed Thriva and Second Nature, you know, and I just feel like that's just the beginning in that space. Insurance industry is another one that's, you know, sort of big and ossified, and the customers are not particularly happy. So that feels like it's got to change. And then the space that I'm personally in, which is ed tech. You know, I think the way people learn just is completely mismatched with the educational institutions and offerings. And I think people in the world are realizing how incredibly valuable and important learning is. And, you know, you talked about like early days before Spotify or the iPod, people were making mixtapes. And I feel like it's the same sort of thing in education. Like it's just the beginning with people wanting to learn how to code or learn English for more educational opportunity. So I feel like there's a huge pent up unmet demand, and the business models and the formats that gets paid off are undergoing incredible innovation right now.
No, I agree with those three. And we've seen large shifts in institutional money going into those sectors.
Yeah, okay.
So definitely. The third quickfire, with the benefit of hindsight, what is one key thing that you would have liked to have known when you were starting your, we'll say investing journey, even though you're an entrepreneur again, what's the one key thing that you would have liked to have known when you were starting out on that journey that you know now?
When I look at all the investments I made, 7 of the 35 were really successful. All of the really successful investors, one of the co-founders had a lot of operating experience doing product or marketing.
Wow.
And the ones that weren't successful, very few, there were some, but very few of them were companies that were built by people who had that particular experience.
Wow, that is a stat that I haven't heard yet. But I mean, it rings true, right?
Because it's a small sample size and it's just one ham-handed investor over a short period of time. But
no, but I mean, you're absolutely right. And it's your, I think part of your reason for the program as well is that you've seen that gap where people could use the help and get focused on the North Star and learn on the job, if you will. But if you have that experience beforehand, it gives you that leg up to try and get traction quicker, which will hopefully lead to the first funding round and the follow-on rounds becoming quicker and larger because you have that traction. And you're right, that comes down to marketing and sales and being focused. So
yeah, and product. Like, can you build a great product and can you get people to use it at the end of the day?
It absolutely makes sense. Well, look, Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I really do mean that. For those that want to find you and find what you're doing, where should they go? What should they do?
Check out startupcorestrengths.com. I publish every Tuesday morning. I send a 2-minute email for founders and marketing leaders that has some kind of actionable tip. It might be, you know, a growth tactic worth stealing that I'm seeing. You know, this week I see the job market is suddenly insanely tight. And so I'm going to have some tips about how to hire good people in a really tight market. So I just send something useful out every Tuesday morning and you can get that at startupcorestrengths.com.
There you go. You heard it from the man himself. Matt, hopefully we can revisit this in 6 or 12 months, see how you're doing, see how the market's going. But until then, be well and thank you again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Always a pleasure chatting to you.
You charmer. You've been listening to Angel Insights, produced by Syndicate Room. Until next time, bye.